to item number 20, Puget Sound Smelt Fishery Regulation Proposals. This is a briefing and a public hearing. Craig Burley and Dave Lowry from the Fish Program.
Oops. Sorry.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Deputy Director Store. I'm Craig Burley, Fish Management Division Manager, and with me is Dr. Dave Lowry, a Senior Research Scientist in our Marine Fish Unit. And today we're going to provide you a briefing on the Puget Sound commercial and recreational surf smelt fisheries. And so what we'll do today is provide you some background information on the policy, the biology of these species, their ecological importance, and the fisheries that we currently have for them. And we'll talk about the rationale for rulemaking, and we'll brief you on the three options that we currently are taking public comment on. We'll summarize the public input that we've received on those options to date, and then wrap up with next steps and any questions that the commission has, and then we'll move into public testimony. So the commission adopted a forage fish management policy, C-3012, in 1998. This is in your commission notebooks under the number 20 tab. And some highlights to mention, the policy directs the department to maintain healthy forage fish populations, to consider the role of forage fish in the marine ecosystem, and the needs to supply sufficient quantities of forage fish for ecosystem needs. Also indicates that if insufficient information exists or conditions of the resource is poor, a conservation or conservative approach to fisheries will be taken. And that finally, achievement of a maximum sustained yield is not a goal of our forage fish management. Turn this over to Dave.
Let me switch microphones. Okay. So surf smelt are a forage fish, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means in just a minute. But to give some general background, they're a relatively short-lived species, living maybe 3 to 4 years and spawning at an age of 1 or 2. Part of that depends on their maturation rate and whether they're large enough to spawn at age 1. Spawning occurs year-round throughout Puget Sound. There are areas in which there's a seasonality to their spawning. They prefer to spawn in the winter or in the summer. In many cases, that's been linked with environmental factors. There are also areas in Puget Sound, especially the central Puget Sound, where you can find these fish spawning any day of the year. Whether those are the same individuals or batches of individuals is something that we've not really established thoroughly. They spawn on gravel and sand, and they spawn intertidally, which is an interesting and kind of a critical aspect of their behavior with respect to interaction with people and with nearshore construction. So basically, they're spawning at high tide, but they're spawning between the high tide and the low tide mark. It's unknown if individuals are repeat spawners and whether spawning fidelity exists, so we're not certain whether individuals are coming back to the same site year after year and whether the same individuals come back after 1 or 2 years. So they may spawn once and be done. So the stock assessment work that we've done with them for several decades has mostly consisted of documenting spawning locations. And this began to occur back in the late 70s and early 80s as a mechanism specifically to identify and then protect spawning habitat. As I said, they spawn in the intertidal and the nearshore, and this puts them into direct interaction or direct contact with many human activities, so building of overwater structures and bulkheads and things like that. They spawn throughout Puget Sound, so you can see on the right-hand side here the green points, and these are actually points that seem to merge into lines, but it's over 30,000 survey points from 1977 to the present, and we've surveyed over 1,000 miles worth of nearshore habitat. And on the blue side, you can see where we found surf smelt spawning at some point or another. Now, bear in mind that some of those points are fairly old. Again, the point here was to document using our use of spawning habitat. habitat, not necessarily to go back and document continuous use of the same location. We do have some genetic research on this species conducted about 3 years ago, and the initial pass suggests that all surf smelt in Puget Sound are one continuous stock. We're doing currently a secondary round of analysis, collecting additional samples and trying to expand our scope to try and really nail that down and see if that's really the best representation of their stock distribution and interrelationship. There is currently no abundance estimate, so the question of do we know how many surf smelt are out there, the simple answer is no, we don't. Habitat protection, as I mentioned before, we do have spawning habitat protection under WAC 22110, and specifically these habitats are defined as nearshore habitats of special concern. This applies to herring, surf smelt, and sand lance spawning habitat. Surf smelt are ecologically important, so we often get the question, well, why do we care so much about this fish? They're a key link in the food chain, and forage fish have been recognized by the Puget Sound Partnership and other management organizations and advisory groups as a key indicator of overall health of the Puget Sound. Specifically, the Puget Sound Partnership uses herring, but the reason that they use herring as opposed to any other forage fish is that we had more information on herring, and that's really why we relied upon that species. Their spawning habitat, as I mentioned, is threatened by shoreline development and sea level rise. Some recent research by one of the scientists in our habitat program has shown that potentially a 6-inch rise in sea level could effectively squeeze out 25% of the eggs that are currently being spawned onto a beach. And this is worsened, of course, by any sort of bulkheads or anything that's blocking off the upper portion of the beach that doesn't effectively allow that beach and that deposition of eggs to migrate landward. Pollution effects. There are likely pollution effects on reproduction, biomass, and other things, other aspects of their biology, but at this point, that's to an unknown degree. We really have no idea how it affects these species. In herring, it's been shown, especially some toxic chemicals associated with oils and oil sheens to directly impact herring egg survival. And we presume at this point that it's also affecting surf smelt because of their location in the nearshore and because of their exposure first to these chemicals and then to UV light, which is really the key pairing of factors that affects herring eggs. So we talked about the ecological importance, and so it's important to put these in the proper placement in the food web to really understand their role. We can click through a couple of slides here and kind of pop these on. So the key role that forage fish plays, or play in the food web, you'll also hear often hear described as a wasp waste food web. And basically what this represents is kind of the general morphology of a wasp. Down at the base, at the bottom of the wasp, you've got primary producers, zooplankton, and small larvae and crab and small fishes. At the upper portion, you've got apex predators like tuna, salmon, sharks, and mid-level predators that they feed on. And then the key link is the forage fish right in the middle. And the reason this is described as wasp waste is usually there's numerous primary producers and larvae and small phytoplankton. There's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of species. Typically for forage fishes, there's only a few species that are important in any given food web. And then all of the upper level and mid-level predators rely upon them. So in our ecosystems, we're talking about birds, marine mammals, fishes, a variety of upper level predators, but really only a handful of forage fish species. So herring, various smelt species, and sand lance. So for our commercial smelt fisheries, we do have a dragnet or beach seine fishery that's currently the sole capture method being used. Actually, on further review, we found out that there have been a couple of landings from our dip bag net fishery in the last 2 years. Prior, though, the 10 years before that, this method had not been used. So our beach seine method is the primary method being used. The purse seine and dip bag net fisheries are still open, but as I said, we've had landings just from one license in the last couple of years using the dip bag net. Smelt fisheries are regulated by season. So we have regional closures, and these closures are designed for basically around two different premises. First, it's to protect early spawning periods. So in all of these areas, we looked at information that we have about when the surf smelt spawned, and then the first portion of that spawning period was set aside as a no-take period. So the goal there was to allow the fish to at least get some eggs in the gravel before having impacts on them from the fisheries. In some locations, we provided exclusively recreational fisheries in the summers. So it's kind of hard to tell. This is a small font, but you'll see that in all areas where it's open, the commercial fisheries close April 15th and typically don't open up until the end of July or into the fall. So that allows for summer recreational fisheries. Hood Canal is currently closed year-round, and it's not just for commercial and recreational smelt fisheries, but for all of our groundfish fisheries, and in fact, most of our fisheries. We have a few crab, shrimp, and some salmon fisheries that are operating in the canal, but for low dissolved oxygen concerns, we closed that down in 2004. Commercial fisheries are also, during the open period, currently closed Fridays and Saturdays in all areas. And again, this is in an effort to allow recreational fisheries to essentially operate without competing directly. So since 2003, the number of licenses issued has increased from 6 to 10. Initially, that looks like a large increase, but I wouldn't make too much out of that. We can discuss the reasons for that later. Essentially, we view this as a fairly stable level of commercial fishery licenses. The more important part to us is that no more than 7 licenses have ever landed smelt during a given year in Puget Sound, and that typically it's 2 to 3 of these licenses or 2 to 3 of these fishers that are really accounting for about 90% of the catch. So how much catch is there? The annual harvest in Puget Sound has increased 74%, comparing the 1970s and 80s to the 90s and 2000s. And the reason that that's relevant is the initial policy that was written, forage fish policy in 1983, talked about what we might do and how we might handle evaluation of these fisheries with changes from the 70s and 80s into the future. And what we've shown here is a breakdown of a couple of different areas. First, the red data series is Puget Sound, not including two smaller areas. The two small areas that we've broken out are 24A and C, and these are the marine areas that occur basically off the northern end of Kamano Island and the western side of Kamano Island. And as you can see, especially in recent years, since about 1995, the vast majority of the harvest has come from this area, north and west of Kamano Island. The X vessel value for this fishery, this is only information that we have, obviously X vessel, so it's at the point of sale when poundage is landed and reported on commercial fish tickets. And you can see that for roughly 100,000 pounds in recent years, the value of the fishery has been in the neighborhood of $60,000 to $70,000. This is largely market driven. The price is driven and the need for delivery to market is driven mostly by demand. So for recreational fisheries, most of the take that's, we believe most of the take is via dip bag nets. There are two different fisheries operating, and it's the dip bag net, which you can see at the bottom and the left-hand side, and then jigging. And jig gear or dip bag fishing occurs mostly for human consumption, and this is personal use. The jig gear is both for consumption and for salmon bait. In some areas, it's almost exclusively for human consumption, and the Laconer smelt derby that's been a longstanding tradition in that area is mostly for human consumption. In other areas, we do know that people are jigging surf smelt for bait for salmon fisheries and groundfish fisheries. The harvest and the effort is almost completely unknown, though, and this is a very unique situation. License is not required. Smelts as a group are one of the only three groups of individual species that you can fish for in the state of Washington without a license. The other two are carp and bullfrogs. So this is a very strange situation in many respects. We also, without having a license in place, we have no method to estimate effort, so we don't have a phone survey or an estimate of license sales or anything to that effect. There have been a few isolated creel survey efforts over the years in different areas of Puget Sound. Most recently, we conducted one off the north side of Kamano Island, and that was 2 years ago in 2012. The estimate was there was that the recreational fishery took about 4,400 pounds, where at the same time the commercial fishery took about 90,000 pounds during that season. The season for the recreational smelt fishery is open year-round sound-wide, except for Hood Canal. It's closed Wednesdays and Thursdays for dip netting, and again, this is to allow the commercial fishery to occur essentially without competition on those days. It is, though, open 7 days a week for jig fisheries. Some of the conservation methods and techniques that we have in place for this fishery are a minimization on or a specification on the mesh size of the nets being used, and this is to prevent gilling of the fish. We also have a daily limit of 10 combined pounds of all forage fish species. Most people that we've encountered fishing smelt will try to fish to 10 pounds of smelt. They're typically not going out and also fishing herring or something else on the same day. Also, all smelt caught must be retained, and this is an effort to keep people from, one, stressing out the individuals and killing them, and secondarily, high-grading to the females, because generally the females are larger than males. So once you catch the fish and have them in the bucket, they have to be retained. Now I'll pass this back over to Craig.
So just to summarize regarding the reason that we're here on this topic, we wanted to make sure and have the opportunity to review the current fisheries relative to the commercial, the commission's policy, and make sure that we're meeting that guidance to look at and recognize the important ecological role of smelt in Puget Sound. As we discussed, the importance of forage fish for our ESA listed species or other species of concern in the Puget Sound. Recognizing that since the 1970s and 80s, compared to recent years, we're seeing an increase in commercial harvest of 74%. This also acknowledges that commercial fishery is an open fishery. It's not a limited entry, so there is an opportunity for this fishery to expand at this point as well. And then also recognizing that our recreational fishery, we don't have effort or harvest estimates for that species other than the limited work that Dave referenced. And we also know that there are conflicts between fishers and landowners in some specific areas around the sound. So the first option that is before us is a status quo, and this is maintaining the current commercial and recreational fishing regulations. Dave touched on those. Option two is a reduction in fisheries. This would close the commercial fishery on Sundays, implementing a 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. night closure as well on those remaining opening days. This option would also implement a night closure for recreational fisheries on each of the open days, Friday through Tuesday. Option two also proposes to close the other two remaining commercial gear types, purse seine and dip bag net. And estimates of a reduction of approximately 40% could be achieved. This would assume that there was no change in fishing behavior and that we would see commensurate reductions with those changes to fisheries. And then finally, option three, this would close all commercial smelt fishing in Puget Sound, as well as implement the night closure for recreational fisheries on those open days, and would include the closure of the purse seine and dip bag net fishery. And this would be the most conservative option that the department has sought public comment on and would result in a significant reduction in overall harvest of smelt in Puget Sound. So the department held a industry meeting in January at the Mill Creek office, as well as a public meeting on March 21st there as well. And there are public comments being taken starting February 24th, and they'll extend through the end of May. The comments that we've received as of April 7th, there were 24 people that attended in total the industry and public meetings. And the departments received 758 comments either through our online commenting tool, as well as a portion have been received through the commission's email. And the breakdown of those comments are 25% of the comments received support option one, status quo, 3% support an option two, which is a reduced fishery, with option three having about 70% of the comments received in support of a closure of the commercial fishery and reduction of the recreational fishery. There were other comments that we received that weren't directly related to these three options, and I'll talk about those in a minute. So comments, we received a number of, we had some themes that developed for the comments that we received. And for option one, we heard that maintaining the current fisheries are supported, and that those commenting didn't see a problem with the resource, that there was not adequate data to justify a reduction in harvest, that the commercial smelt fishery in the Lopez Island area is a community event and a small fishery, well supported, and a recommendations not to close that fishery. And that finally, if there were problems with homeowners, that those areas should be addressed specifically in those locations. The comments that we received in support of option two indicated that reducing the fishing until better understanding of the smelt population is known would be supported, that a more conservative approach is needed to provide smelt as food for other species, and that there was some preference for night fishing to occur, and if that closure was needed, that it be restricted to the North Camino Island area where the majority of the current harvest is occurring. Relative to option three, we received comments that supported this option as a to conserve smelt for, again, other species in the food chain, that it was important to protect smelt to assist with restoration of salmon, steelhead, and other species, that option three would prevent overfishing of smelt, and that there were concerns expressed for the drop in smelt numbers from historical levels in certain areas. Other comments that we received included a recommendation for recreational license to help fund studies for smelt in Puget Sound. There was a recommendation to limit the number of commercial licenses to stabilize harvest. We also received comments to reopen harvest of smelt in the Hood Canal area. And finally, we heard some comments that the department should have considered a fourth option that would close all commercial and recreational fishing for smelt to provide that ecological benefits in the sound. And so where we are then is today, there's a public hearing after we're done with this briefing, and then the commission will be asked to take action at the June 13-14 meeting. And with that, we'd take any questions.
Thank you. Very good. Commissioner Kenny?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greg, I was just curious, was there any consideration of adding a license and or reporting requirement to any or all of the options? To see then, you know, what the results might be, or to provide enough data to justify one of the options or another.
Thank you, Commissioner Keeney. The department has proposed a license for smelt. I believe it was in the mid-2000s when Columbia River smelt were proposed for listing. We took that to the legislature, which requires legislative action in order to require a license. That did not pass through session at that time. The department could consider that again. It's unclear, given the number of people that likely participate in other species as well as the smelt fishery, how many additional licenses would be sold. We could consider some accounting similar to what we do with salmon or steelhead. We would need to look at those things further. I would recommend before we move forward with a license. And so in the absence of an ability to account fully for the abundance of the resource and the full harvest, we're recommending looking at the policy to see if there's other conservative actions to take.
Any other questions? Okay. I haven't seen the concept of the wasp's waste food, right. Web, whatever it's called. Yeah. So there's few species within the category of forage fish. That suggests that there might be a conservation concern. We heard the new director of the Washington Audubon Society come in and talk with us yesterday about their emphasis on forage fish as in its importance to birds. So can you give us the flavor of your thinking about whether if we reduced the smelt or other forage fish fishery, whether we would see a significant benefit to fish, salmon, steelhead? Because we do have a big steelhead and salmon problem in Puget Sound.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. There have been several studies over the last couple of years, and most specifically, there was one called A Third for the Birds, or that was kind of the informal title that was passed around, where essentially they evaluated marine seabirds that are feeding on forage fishes in a variety of locations around the world. And these range from South America to Southern California to Norway. And essentially, they looked at impacts directly from biomass estimates of how many fish were available, and then commercial take and recreational take associated with fisheries in the area. And effectively, repeatedly, they showed that if you're not leaving a third of the standing biomass in the water just for seabird diet, you tend to have seabird crashes occurring. So with tufted puffins, marbled murrelets, other seabirds in the area, just considering seabirds, you might need a third of the standing biomass to be left in the water. The major problem we have with trying to manage in that way is that we have no estimate of standing biomass. So the thought that we're seeing problems and those problems may be indicative of a lack of available forage fish, that's certainly one conclusion. Without being able to evaluate how many are out there and how many are currently available to the birds, it's hard to say directly. There's also been several studies over the past few years showing that marine mammals rely heavily on forage fish. Specifically in the San Juan Islands, our own fish and wildlife biologists have been studying harbor seal diet and showing what a critical component herring are to harbor seal diets. So this is where the complexity of trying to figure out what's out there, what's available, and what's being utilized by these species really comes into play.
Okay. Did the Fish Committee have this on your agenda?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you think, Fish Committee?
What do we think?
Yeah, what are your main questions in relation to this topic? Did you ask staff for additional information before we make a decision, or what's the
information? That's July, June.
I mean, I know we're not making a decision now, but did you discuss the issue in some detail? And can you give us a sense of how your discussion unfolded?
Well, pretty much what we heard is.
Can you put the mic closer? Yeah.
Pretty much
what we heard was what you just heard right now. I think there was general concern over the problem of harvesting low in the food chain and not knowing what you're harvesting. I am not necessarily a fan of, if you have that kind of a problem, I think you need to go very, very carefully on these types of issues. We got multiple species. You don't know at this point. You're not exactly sure where they're spawning. You don't know what the result of that spawning is in the ecosystem. You've got birds to consider. You've got marine mammals to consider, and you've got salmonids and other species of fish to consider. I think we need to go very, very carefully on this issue. And the fact that the Puget Sound Partnership has said that they feel, their scientific staff feels, that this is a key issue in the recovery of other species within Puget Sound, I think we need to be very, very careful on this.
Well, one of the points we heard yesterday from Gail Groton from Audubon was that they felt Washington was rather progressive in this area, that we were certainly controlling our forage fish harvest more than Oregon, so we were looked at with envy as a model. And so I think we're starting in a better place anyway. So it's a question of, how much more we need to do. And I guess that's why there's some diversity of viewpoints.
Well, I think you have to be very careful when you apply the precautionary approach. But when you have as little information as we do here, I think the invocation of a precautionary approach is probably something we need to consider.
Okay. And one other question about the coast and the estuaries. Have the surveys been done in the coastal estuaries, Willapa and Grace Harbor? Do we know how the spawning beds are in those estuaries? Because I've heard some questions raised about those places.
Yes, so the vast majority of information that's been collected on a statewide basis was collected by one and then on occasion a few other individuals operating out of the LaConner office.
Okay.
So Dan Pentilla, one of our biologists, was the primary person doing these surveys. If you go back and look at the data, we have approximately 30,000 or a little bit over 30,000 survey points in Puget Sound. By contrast, we have roughly 80 in Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor combined. And this past year, through some marine spatial planning money, a research project was funded on the entire outer coast. Unfortunately, because it was marine spatial planning and they specifically excluded Willapa and Grays Harbor, it was only the outer coast. We have now hundreds of surveys going from Nia Bay down to the Columbia River, but they cut off right at the entrances to the estuaries.
You refresh my memory. There was a lot of controversy about the use of marine spatial planning money. For the, I think, was it smelt or all forage fish?
It was smelt and sandlance, but really we were focusing on smelt. Mostly because we believe in those areas sandlance would spawn in an area low enough in the intertidal that any sort of survey effort would involve people getting beat up by waves quite a bit. They also tend to spawn in the winter inside Puget Sound, and if that's the case, the wave action on the outer coast is considerably more during that time of year.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Smith?
Well, not the wave question might have answered part of my question, but I was thinking this might be a great opportunity for citizen science, invoking the Audubon chapters or something like that in doing some of the survey work, but not putting them in harm's way of the wave action. So.
Right, and thank you, Commissioner Smith. A very important aspect of our recent research with forage fish has been community involvement and trying to get citizen scientists to do these surveys. We've been collaborating, when Dan was doing this work back in the 70s and 80s, he was trying to collaborate with citizen scientists. In the past few years, the Northwest Straits Commission, several of the marine resource committees in different areas, we've tried to organize some community-based surveys on the outer coast. And initially, the approach there was that we would try to get some baseline data and then try to roll in the Jefferson and Clallam County and other marine resource committees. So our hope is to expand that kind of survey work into the future, both inside and outside of Puget Sound.
Okay. Anything else? Great job. Very nice. Thank you. Okay. Do we have people have signed up? Wow. Lots of interest in this subject. We have 20 people who've signed up to provide testimony, so I'm going to really hold you to the three-minute rule, as we're going to be here for more than an hour listening to public comment. And as I said, the commission offers citizens 3 minutes to testify. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up and we'd like you to wrap it up, meaning finish your sentence, and then we'd appreciate you stepping down for the next person. So I'll call up two people at a time, and the first two are Ron Garner and David Jennings.
Ron's going to pass.
Oh, okay. Then John Becker. Okay, Mr. Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fellow commissioners, or commissioners.
We're still fellow.
Yes.
In the heart.
I did have the opportunity to attend on behalf of Audubon and Audubon chapters of Washington, the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting this week, where the council addressed unmanaged forage fish. Forage fish is a big topic for Audubon right now. Up and down the coast, we had California, Oregon, and Washington chapters represented talking about it there. And it is nice, let me just pause to say, first, it was really nice to see Michelle Culver and Rich Lincoln representing the department, the commission, and the state of Washington at that. They did a really nice job. It was really nice to see them there. The council ended up making a unanimous decision to manage currently unmanaged forage fish as ecologically important when they come up with levels in the future if a fishery develops. It was so nice to see that Washington's already ahead of that, at least on paper. Option three is where I think we need to end up in the short term. I'm not sure it goes far enough. As we heard, forage fish are important for a lot of different reasons, but one for Audubon is seabirds, and you heard the third for birds. Our marine seabirds in Puget Sound have been declining for years. The marble murrelet population in Washington is declining at the most rapid rate of any state population in the country. And part of the reason for the decline has been attributed to a decrease in both quality and quantity of forage fish. Takes it right there. When we look at climate change and ocean acidification, off the Puget Sound, off our Washington coast, is the epicenter for the most largest changes in water chemistry we're seeing anywhere in the world. We don't know what the implications are in the future. Again, points back to an important reason for the precautionary approach that we're taking. Anecdotally, I dive a lot, and in the past several years in Hood Canal, I haven't even seen sand lance. I haven't seen smelt in the water columns, and I used to see them. So I am saying I think there's a big decline occurring. It was very disturbing in the presentation we just heard. We have no idea of age class structure. We have no idea of population estimate, which means we have no idea of trends over time. And this is, as we talked about, a very key number of small number of species that are really crucial for the overall ecosystem health. When we look at the impacts of degradation from people, we have the equivalent of a major oil spill every year getting into Puget Sound. So again, you know, from the non-point source pollution, from the drippings, it's not all one release, but the quantity of oil that goes into Puget Sound is equivalent to an oil tanker. So we do have concerns about overall long-term health. So adopting option three and going to continue to look to see if we need to do more, I think, is key. So thank you for this consideration on this topic.
Thank you. Good job. Dana Bodnichuk, hope I pronounced your name right. And Mr. Becker.
Madam Chairman and other commissioners, my name is John Becker, and I live in Bremerton, in the Minette area of Bremerton. It happens to be one of the 1 mile section of the 10 miles worth of spawning area that there is in the central Silverdale, Paul's Bow area and Bainbridge Island that exists. I lived there for 13 years, and I could almost set my clock, and I could tell you what kind of birds were going to be out there and what kind of, you know, fish were going to be out there and what was going to happen in the water until this last year, last winter. And the first time I ever saw, I saw seine netter come out to net surf smelt on my beach, on the beach. I call it my beach, but it's our beach. And he came out there, and he was netting 150 to 200 pounds of smelt per high tide. And he was there for months. And I called the Game and Fish Department and asked him if that, you know, is this legal? Can you just go out? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, can you take anything you want? Oh, yeah, you can. Well, I said, well, you know, what happens if they take 99% of all the smelt out there? I said, well, they can't. Well, this happens to be 10% of all the spawning area in the Central Sound. Well, what happened is that after this had occurred, I noticed a couple things. You know, before, you know, you would always see the smelt coming to the surface when the fish were underneath of them. You would see the diving sea ducks would go out and catch, and you'd see the blue herons that would come on low tide all the time. After they would fish this that's heavily fished, I don't see the blue herons anymore. I don't see the diving ducks anymore. I don't see any pods of smelt rising. Now, this is 1/10 of the central, you know, area. One of the things I learned when I was in the Navy, I'm a retired Navy, that we in the nuclear Navy, we looked at the root cause of a problem. And I've heard the questions, I've heard the other people make their sounds. I believe the root cause of the problem is we're overfishing the smelt population, especially in the areas where they have their spawning. You know, if you can allow somebody to take out 99% of all the smelt in one area where it happens to be to represent 10% of all the spawning area in one region, you're really affecting all kinds of species. And you're expecting, the bird, mammal, and fish feed species. The coal miners had their canaries, you know, to indicate to them when they had problems in the coal mines. Well, we have the absence of the herons, the diving ducks, and the smelt. They're not driven to the surface. The message to me, and I hope to the commissioners, is that we choose option 3, which is close, you know, the smelt fishing. Commercial smelt fishing. I gave you some pictures up there so you could see. And it shows how, you know, they show these little things and there's 10 smelt in there and, you know, what the Dr. Lowry showed up here. Well, you can show you how many it is. I mean, 150 smelt, 150 pounds or 200 pounds of smelt is huge. And I just want to make sure that you saw those pictures. And also I gave you a picture of the blue herons that are no longer on my beach. And if we let this go on, it might not be on other people's beaches also. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Paul Rochon. Okay. Ms. Bernardchuk.
I'm Dana Bernardchuk, and I lived on, the big beach in Houston from Ezalati to Rocky Point, where 90% of the smelt commercial fisheries has been taken. And I'll be brief. I think everything I want to say has been said or will be said, but... from what I've seen in the last 10 years, we've gone to where we would have smelt coming in for like 45 minutes to an hour, maybe an hour and a half on occasions, 2 to 3 times a week. Last summer, the big populations came in 3 times over, I would say, from April till October. And it's frightening just as a citizen, because you know what's, if there's not food for the animals, they're going to disappear too, and we're going to end up with nothing too late. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Douglas Davies. Okay, Mr. Richon.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, members of the Commission, thank you for having me. I'm not going to go through a lot of the other stuff that some of the people are going to bring up, but to me it's very disturbing that in 24A, 24C, that you're looking at 75% of the smelt being taken. When you look at the miles of smelt beaches, you know, that's a big percentage. And as you're going to hear from these people, every year it's been decreasing. Now, we hear that there's a lack of data. There's, you know, you just don't have the resources and the money to go out and really do what needs to be done. So what I'm hoping is that as these people are coming up and telling you, they lived there, they've been there for years, they've seen what's going on, and with that lack of data, maybe, you know, what they're saying is, you know, some beneficial, you know, information and data to show that, yes, things are decreasing. And as things start to decrease, so does everything else. You know, in one of the slides, it showed that you had the, you know, the eagles up here, you know, as part of the food chain. Well, the eagles are now eating and fishing for the forage fish, compared to, you know, the way the food chain should go. So things, you know, are really, you know, getting to be, you know, difficult up there. So I'm just hoping that you take and pay attention, you know, a little bit and take on, you know, what these people are saying as data. Because until resources are, you know, put out there, nobody's going to know. And I would hope that you would err on the side of the smelt, you know, because, you know, and not on the other side of saying, hey, we need more data and take, you know, four or five more years to, you know, collect that data, because it could be too late. And, you know, just by, you know, the information that you have in your booklet, there's no mitigation factors in there for replacing. They don't know how to replace, you know, something once it's gone. So, you know, use caution and, you know, err on the side of the smelt before, you know, until you do get the right data, you know. So that's basically what I would say, and thank you.
Thank you. Randy O'Brien? Okay, Mr. Davies?
Hi, I'm Doug Davies. I'm friends of the people who are here. My folks lived on the island 30, 40 years ago. And I since moved up to Stanwood, and we built a house up there, and we used to go out and do smelt, be invited over for dinner, you know, come over, the smelter running. And that hasn't happened in the last 20 years. It's just not available the way it was. I did download your whole management plan. In order to manage something, you have to know what you've got to start with. So the very first thing that has to happen is you have to be able to, instead of having one single data point 2 years ago where they went out and surveyed the guys that were actually catching them on the beach, they actually need to put some money into figuring out what we have as a resource there before, so we can tell how we're going to manage it. If we don't know what the spawning is, we don't know how many are coming off of it, we don't know actually how many we're taking, it seems like it's a lost effort to try and say, well, we're going to do this, and it's based on what? We don't know what we're basing any of our decisions on. So first we need to put some other thing we were talking about, the other one of the meetings, was that they didn't have the resources to put people out there to even enforce and go out and look at what people were taking off the beach, let alone go out there and do the research to find out what's available for the smelt to be able to reproduce. So before you start off with something, I think the very best thing would be to do find in favor of the smelt. Since that's a pinch point in our fisheries in this area, we need to look to that, find out where we are first.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Penny Feister? Okay, Mr. O'Brien?
Yes, hello. I'm Randy O'Brien. I'm from Lopez Island. I'm a commercial smelt fisherman, and I've been doing it for several years. What I'm seeing here is I'm seeing many things, but primarily there's two things going on. There's an issue with the property owners on Camino Island. That's a local thing, and they're angry at the smelt fishermen. That's an issue. And there's also an issue of, or proposed to be an issue, of that there's actually some sort of problem with the smelt stocks. And maybe there is locally, and maybe there isn't. If the state had followed its own policy, the C3012, if you read that, which I think you have, read down in the thing, you'll see where after the first thing, they're supposed to have come up with estimates of stocks and whatnot. Without that information, all you have to go on are the catch records. And if please look carefully your own selves at the catch records. In the 1970s, the records, there was 20-some guys were fishing there, about 70,000 pounds a year was the average catch. Through the 80s, it trended down to the low point in the 1990 where there were 17,000 pounds caught. Now, I remember the 1990s very well. That's when I got started in working as with the old man. There was lots of fish around, lots and lots of fish, even though the catch was only 17,000 pounds. But what it was is the old men that used to go out there and catch the stuff had died, or the few that were left were old, and they just didn't put much effort into it. I started in the 1990s. Starting in 1994, the catch went up tremendously. From 1994 to the year 2000, please look at these for yourself rather than just relying upon the summary. It went up tremendously. To the year 2000, it was like 140-some-odd thousand pounds per year. For the last 13 years, though, since 2001, it has been relatively stable. There's been some ups and downs, but it's relatively stable. These are two-year fish. If there was a lot of fish being taken out, it wouldn't take 13 years to show a reduction in the population. It would show sooner. The fish... I personally am, I have been keeping records for over 20 years. The stocks go up, they go down. But where I see them in my own place where I fish is they're relatively stable. They're not up, they're not down, they fluctuate, but they're well within what I've been seeing. I do not want to see the end of the smelt because I like to fish it. There is a lot of public support on Lopez Island for commercial fishing, and I don't know about if you know about the San Juans, but it's really a bastion of a lot of very liberal and greeny people. And to get anyone there to support commercial fishing is really saying a lot. Please read the statements that they were able to submit online. Please read their comments. When I was looking at it, I got different numbers than what Mr. Burley did. When I looked at the information provided me online comments, it was 56% of the people were in support of the commercial fishing option number one. And that's a huge discrepancy because he came up with 20-some-odd. Please look at those yourself and read them yourselves because what they have to say, particularly for the San Juan Islands, is very telling, better than I can say for my own self. And I just strongly... Until you get more information, please just leave it as it is. There doesn't seem to be a crash at this time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Jim Shields.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to provide you with observation and anecdotal firsthand eyewitness to what has happened to our smelt fishery on the north end of Camano Island, particularly at Maple Grove. My parents bought the original property in 1945, so it's been my permanent, temporary, part-time retirement home since then. I had the good fortune to grow up with some of my friends who are here on the beach catching smelt with our hands, as much of a wonderful, joyful childhood as you could ask for. That doesn't exist. My grandchildren don't know. Contrary to the gentleman that just spoke so positively about Lopez Island, Maple Grove and the north end of Camano Island's experience has been absolutely dramatically different, radically different, and the opposite end. We talk about, and I appreciate the Audubon Society being here and being involved in advocating for the restoration of this valuable forage fish. We watch the eagles fish. Who in Nebraska can say they can watch eagles fish? My grandchildren can watch eagles fish for smelt. But if they're not there, the seabirds, the seals, the otters, that ecosystem is valuable to maintaining what we have on the north end of Camano Island and in all of Puget Sound and the Salish Sea. This fishery must be managed, and we strongly, those 20% or 20 of us, the majority of here, I ask you to please, please consider option three. In the formal presentation that was given, there was also addressed the recreational fishermen, and we'd like the opportunity to speak with you at another time when it's more appropriate to do that. But there's come a time in 2014 that we need to say on behalf of our children, on behalf of our environment, that enough is enough. We have, if you want to talk to Sheriff Mark Brown from Island County, with the issues of the neighborhood and the commercial fishermen and their overfishing, their abuse of their privilege and their license, and watching them take more than what was legally allowed. But how do you enforce it? If there's no staff to enforce it, it's not illegal. We know it's illegal. They know it's illegal. But the underfunding of our law enforcement and our fisheries department doesn't allow for that enforcement. Again, I thank you for this opportunity to address you. I just hope that you will consider option three as the right source and the right decision to make in June. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you all put your phones on mute or vibrate? Because that's very distracting. Wayne English, please come forward. Okay, Mr. Shields.
Jim Shields. Excuse me, Jim Shields from the northwest side of Camino Island. My role initially was to introduce the people that had come down and didn't realize the sequencing, but I will take a moment. I'd like to introduce Paul Rochon, who's the president of the Maple Grove Neighborhood Association. I'd like to introduce Rob Plaza, who is the Accolade Neighborhood President. I'd like to introduce Linda Town, who's been here for over 30 years, Mike Town, over 50 years. I'd like to introduce Doug Davies, who you've already seen, who is a Stanwood resident, and I'd like to introduce Tony Polychronopoulos. Tony, where are you? There he is. And an avid fisherman, and he's been here for over 15 years. Penny Feaster, who just spoke, has been here over 60 years, grew up on Camino. And Gordon Rue, who's been here for over 20 years. I think you know Gordon. I've been here since, I've been on Camino since 1969 full-time, grew up in Edmonds, and my grandfather built a place on Camino, so I've been observing smelt since I was about five that I can recall. I'd like to say that the people here are going to address option three as the primary option. You heard very eloquently from a few other people the loss that we've seen in smelt production, or smelt arrivals, for lack of a better term here. The folks, I think, are going to be talking about the increased harvest, which you can see on here on your chart, and I hope you'll reference this before your decision, has gone up from 57,000 to 100,000 pounds. That's your staff talking. If you look at Camino, you'll see that over half of the smelt being taken, that's in the green and the blue, represent over half over all of Puget Sound, which is the red. We have seen this reduction in smelt. In the last 5 years, it's been significant. When I was younger, we could walk along the beaches and by accident kill smelt by walking in the water. We could take them by hand. My son is 40, and it was a rite of passage, could take them by hand. No longer. Last year, for the first time ever, people go to the beach and couldn't get a minimum allotment of smelt to meet their minimum catch. I'd like to also say that, and we've also seen, there's eagle pictures that I submitted. We have never seen eagles foraging for smelt before till 5 years ago. They're now very, very into the beaches, and I hope that before you leave, you'll get those. I made a copy for each one of you. My wife took the pictures, and it shows them smelting, which we just haven't seen before, I presume, from growth, loss of habitat. I don't know. I'm not a fisheries expert, but I think the Audubon people are speaking to this issue very effectively, and we need to protect the herons, the eagles, the marine fish, and so on, marine birds, and so on. I thank you. I hope you'll listen very carefully. We're very, very pro-smelt. I'm going to skip the issue about the hostile fisheries.
Thank you
very, very much.
Okay. Is this Thomas Sanford? Have you signed up to testify?
I'm here to speak for him if he has trouble speaking.
Okay, great.
I have Parkinson's. I can't keep up statements for very long, but I could give a very brief presentation and then turn it over to Colin.
Okay.
I've been living on Outside Bay for 30 years, and I've seen such a decline in the last few years, as everybody else has been talking about also. I'd just like to mention three recommendations after we're done here at the end. So give me just about 30 seconds when you're done.
Sure. You want me to read the whole thing?
Well, whatever you... Yeah, sure, if you can. But better make it quick.
My wife and children and I are avid birders, and the abundance of life we found on the beaches of the Puget Sound is a major attraction since we've come here when they came here over 30 years ago. At the time, the smelt runs were big and a regular sight. Seagulls lined up along the beaches in anticipation, and their call was loud and excited. Dogfish would follow the smelt, almost beaching themselves. Diving birds were common in the bay, including loons, buffleheads, grebes, scoters. People with homemade rakes designed to catch the few smelt on the shore or would line the shore. It's different now. The seagulls come, but they're smaller in number. The dogfish are almost never seen. Diving birds are on the bay, but in much fewer number. Neighbors seldom seem to bother to try and catch the smelt that do remain. This is only my viewpoint, but talking to others, my impression is that I am not alone in noticing there have been a decline in the species that were common when we arrived in the early 80s. When I look for answers about what might have happened to the smelt and the bird populations, people tell me that the data is limited and it's hard to say for sure. But others agree with me. The amount of smelt and birds we saw when we moved here has decreased over the last 30 years. I know this is a complex issue, but I think that the Fish and Wildlife needs to act even in the absence of hard data. In the absence of hard data, you should give these fish some protection, the same protection as others, such as salmon. I want to see option 3 enacted to preserve for our children a great experience, the experience of nature. I want to see guidelines which will help promote the smelt survival. This means licensing recreational smelting, limiting the size of smelt rake, and limiting the definition of recreational catch to a specific number of fish per person rather than gallons per bucket.
Well, you said it all. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, Rob Plaza, I think it's...
So I'm a neighbor of Wayne English. Wayne and I would talk about this situation. I thought, well, you know, animals move around. It may not be a serious problem. But my wife's a birder, and she began to bird on me that there weren't the birds that she was wanting to see, and we began to not take the binoculars as we walked around. So clearly it became, I'm not a smelt harvester, although I have smelted, but I began to sort of be more worried about the overall consequences, and did participate in some workshops at Peace Arch and things like this, and became more aware. What sort of pushed me over the edge was that one-third of the, this is a Science magazine in which that really important article on save one-third of the fish for the birds. And I really think that I'm just reinforcing what the majority of people have said here. There's a perception of a serious problem. We've got to move cautiously. We lack the data. There's clear sort of anecdotal, but I think substantive information about the changes that are occurring. This is on, of course, North Kamano Island. So we need to have some sense of the abundance in the standing crop in order to decide what to do. And so I think that option 3 is the way to go, and that's what I'm hoping that you'll perceive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Plaza, you'll need to move over to the mic there. Dorsey Moody, would you come forward?
Thank you, Rob Plaza. I'm the sitting president of the Ocalati Homeowners Association. I've also been asked to come down here today on behalf of our direct neighbors to the east. We are High Bluff Maple Grove homeowners. We are also private tideland owners. And we are here to, or I'm here to support option 3. I also would like to say that I'm very happy to hear that the Audubon Society was here, and my own journey with this over the last 3 or 4 years has been educational and informative. A big point of consternation up on our bluff is the lack of data, which has already been discussed. Amongst my neighbors, I can tell you that my direct neighbor, her grandfather logged most of Kamano Island. Her father developed about a third of the island. She is in her 70s, and there is now 2 generations after her and 1 on the way. So they have a permanent presence. Our plat was actually deeded for private development by a lumber company before Washington was a state. And as a result of that, many of my neighbors have had their families have had a constant presence on the High Bluff of Maple Grove, literally since it was a territory. I can tell you that my neighbor in her 70s will tell me with tears in her eyes as we're standing on the beach of the days when the water would literally boil with spawning smelt. These little guys, you know, they you can see them about 10 feet out from our landing on our stairways or standing on the bluff, and they cruise the shoreline about 10 feet out, a big, long, it looks brown if you're on a sunny day, and then they will ball up and they will head in. Now, I am the lucky tideland owner of a freshwater spring that comes halfway out of the bluff. It's not present on the surface. There's a granite plate that the groundwater collects, and there's a series of waterfalls that come down my bluff. I'm about 200 feet up, and these smelt quite often will ball up, and they will charge right into the fresh water. They can smell it, and I've seen them put their belly right up on the sand, and they're trying to swim right out of the water, which makes, if according to your statistics, which was news to me, if you were to look at a dartboard, and if you were to pick up a dart and throw that dart in the bullseye, there's a very good chance that the high bluff of Maple Grove is that bullseye for commercial smelting. They are a constant presence on our beaches, and this would be virtually every high tide through the season. I think some years ago they were had a presence on liveaboard boats where they would stay there for the 5 days, fish the morning tide and the afternoon tide, and then go by 12-foot. Oh. Option three.
Thank you. Thank you. Tim, now I'm not sure what the last name is. Merrily? Manley? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Moody?
Okay. Lots of history on Kamano Island I'm hearing today, but I haven't heard that the fact is that this smelt fishery, commercially, it was in existence before statehood as well in the Hootsalatte area, and that it's still going 125 years plus later. That says something. The drag seine fishery is where it all started for me back in the 80s with pile perch and smelt, and I'm currently involved in six fisheries alone in the state in different areas. I came back to this fishery in direct response. The truth is, I haven't landed a smelt in a dozen years, but I intend to. It was pinched in the recreational allocation changes with the Puget Sound crab fishery. It pinched my income some. Also, when we lost the smelt fishery in Hood Canal, that's 5 minutes from my house, that I'm back. I came back. I got a net and a boat put together late last year, too late, really. I went out a few times and never found a commercial quantity, which isn't really an alarm. I've seen fisheries or the smelt fail in some areas. Next year, they're back real strong. It's just a fact of what they do. Recreational impact, there's no numbers for the recreational. That's a bit scary. Population growth. Granted, the harvest has increased in years. That could be, you know, right, related to the growth in population, and the state's also increased. Public needs to understand that fresh fish come from somewhere, and that isn't always pretty. They come from somewhere, whether it be an ocean dragger or somebody fishing on a tidelands that may or may not be actually owned by the landowner. I am, you know, in favor of option one. We're putting a fire out before there's ever any smoke. It's not too late. The smelt seem to be strong everywhere. Like I said, it's been going on for a very long time in this state. That's all I have.
Thank you. Okay, Gordon Rue. Okay, Mr. Morelli.
It's Tim Morelli.
Thank you.
I support option three. Fish and Game has no information on the population of smelt in Puget Sound, but they appear to want to impress you with the reported catch numbers, not total smelt population. My family has owned property on the north end of Kamano Island up on the bank that has been reported previous for 39 years. I've spent my whole life on that beach. I've watched the smelt spawn for all these years, and in the last 13 years, the run has declined dramatically. In the last 5 years, I have not smelted due to lack of fish. I know 300 feet of the beach because that's where my two neighbors are on the other each side of me. I know when the smelt will come up and spawn. I have not seen them boil in the last 5 years. Have I seen them boil? Yes. I have a 15-foot aluminum boat, and a friend of mine, about 12 years, 13 years ago, I brought her into the beach. She leaned over the front of the boat and was able to scoop smelt with her hand into a bucket. Unbelievable, I was told. The seagulls would line the beach waiting for the smelt. Most of them are gone. Eagles would sit in the trees and wait. One day, a friend of mine was there and counted 28 eagles sitting in the trees watching for the smelt. The eagles do not come back like that. Why is Fish and Game allowing commercial harvest of smelt on spawning grounds? If we did that to salmon, what would happen to the salmon? Fish and Game did stop dragging for bottom fish in the area, but the fish have not returned in over 20 years. Herring at Cherry Point have not returned after the overharvest of the herring by commercials. The population is less than 50% of what it was. Sardines have vanished from Puget Sound. That is coming from a Fish and Game biologist that landed on our beach in 2012. He said, herring, we've taken care of that because there's not a lot of herring left. And the sardines are gone, so now we're going to focus on smelt. Based on their history, I'm worried about the smelt. If 70 to 80% of the harvest, commercial harvest, is coming from the north end of Kamano Island, what happened to the rest of the Puget Sound smelt? Talk to the people that live in the areas, and they'll tell you the same thing. The commercials have overfished the stocks and then moved on. The fish has not returned to normal levels. Don't let this happen to the rest of Puget Sound smelt in this area. Smelt are forage fish. They feed salmon, bottom fish. I support option three. Thank you.
Sherry Stoiken. Okay, Mr. Rube.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gordon Rube, and I wish to thank you for recognizing the importance of forage fish in undertaking this review. I'd like to read a paragraph from the current management plan, and I do apologize for reading this, but I think it's very important in what you're hearing today and this decision going forward. And that paragraph is this. Most management plans, I'm referring to the forage fish plan, most management plans emphasize yield or catch as a major goal. This plan, the current plan that's in effect, emphasizes the role of forage fish in the ecosystem and considers catch on a secondary basis. The availability of forage fish to provide a food source for salmon, other fish, marine birds, and marine mammals will be the primary consideration. That is what I hope you go by when you make your decision and support option three going forward. It's not, from what you hear today from Dave and Craig, it's not what we do know, it's more what we don't know. We don't know the biomass. We don't know if it's contracting or expanding. We don't know the rate of commercial exploitation or recreational exploitation. We know in certain cases that the smelt are still spawning on the beaches that they historically have. But we don't know in what abundance. Is that, are they at 5% or 20% of the 10-year figure or the 20-year average? We don't know that. We don't have the money to study that. A forage fish study is called the Linfish Forage Fish Task Force. They did a major organization, did a worldwide study of forage fish populations. They came up with some very important findings that are applicable to Puget Sound and everywhere else. And it says they came up with, first and foremost, forage fish abundance is highly vulnerable, often unpredictable, and sensitive to changes in environmental conditions. An example of that, in South Sound, they're now doing forage fish trawls. Those trawls that did come up previously full of smelt and herring and other forage fish are now coming up with jellyfish. Several pockets of Puget Sound have become essentially dead zones, since, as it was explained to me so that I can understand it, higher level predators don't want to eat jellyfish sandwiches. Those areas are dying. Another thing that we found is that because forage fish form dense schools, they are often caught even though their abundance is low. So just because we see a school of fish doesn't mean, that's not a good indicator of what the population is. It may be the last school that we circle with a net. And also they came up from strictly an economic perspective, forage fish are more valuable when left alone to serve as food for higher order predators such as salmon. In Dave's presentation, using the numbers in that presentation for 2013, the ex special value of these smelt caught was 55 cents a pound. I say that there's a much higher economic value if left for salmon, and from a societal standpoint, there's a much higher value if those forage fish, smelt in particular, are there for the salmon, there for the marine mammals, and there for the birds. Please support option three.
Thank you. Terry Cousins. Okay, Ms. Stockin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Director Anderson, members of the Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this process and address you today. I'm here as a private citizen. However, as a lifelong fisher in Washington State, I've also been past state board president of Puget Sound Anglers. I've been a charter captain and had the privilege of working with late Senator Bob Oak on natural resource issues, as well as the wild salmon policy and volunteering with enforcement. And one of the things with wild salmon policy in the restoration of our fisheries was when we had fisheries, they had to be enforceable. And, you know, I've witnessed the fishery up on Kamano Island, and it's not enforceable. It's high bank waterfront. And I remember as Ross Point as a kid that the smelt flopped out of the bucket. My job as a three-year-old was to throw them back in the bucket. Minette, Hood Canal, all of those areas with my family. It was a great family activity. And during the 60s, when they took the orcas and had them there in Waterman Point, that one of the things that they said was that the orcas eat the smelt. And there's a lot of smelt in that Anadyomene Inlet area. And so I've had opportunity 10, 15 years ago to have little kids in a boat down on High Bank Waterfront, and just watching the smelt boil, watching the eagles, I get verklempt thinking about it, but watching the eagles just bobbing like seagulls on those smelt is an incredible sight that I haven't seen for quite a while. I've had problems where they've tied onto the steps going down to the beach, so they're, you know, places that's not enforceable. By the time we call Fish and Wildlife, the tide has come and gone. They anchor their boats. They fish both high tides, day and night, 7 days a week, and enforcement isn't happening, wasn't happening, and there's not really a lot of smelt left anyway to enforce on. So my concern is escapement or lack thereof, and with that type of fishing practices. And I would encourage option three. I would like option four if nobody fishes until we know the health of the biomass, but that's not one of our options here today. So I think we need to really focus on conservation of the species. We look at the places that still maintain orca populations in captivity. Smelt is what they feed the juvenile orcas. And since we do have the possibility of orcas driving ESA listing in Puget Sound, I think it's important that we look at all of our biomasses from the planktons to the salmon in this in your decision. And thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you. Harvey Cousins, would you come forward? Okay, Ms. Cousins.
Hello, my name is Terry Cousins, and I'm from Port Orchard. I am a commercial license holder for smelt. I find it interesting to hear that there's no data in the department for the smelt, and I've heard that almost from everybody that spoke. But if you look in your own documentation, you'll find it. There's the Washington State Surf Smelt Fact Sheet, which shows you there's 259 miles of shoreline that are documented surf smelt spawning areas. There's no 9 miles here, 9 miles there. It's everywhere in the state of Washington. They appear abundantly throughout and the nearshore marine waters of Washington. There was a study, a biology study conducted by your department, and I provided that documentation. They'll send you an email with all the attachments, showing that in 1995, the commercial harvest rate of smelt surf smelt was less than 1% of the Puget Sound biomass. So you have at least 10 million documented for a biomass out there in pounds of smelt. We barely touch that. There's data regarding catch amounts by commercial fishermen that I provided you with multiple years to demonstrate that we don't take a whole bunch of fish. We take what the market calls for. We don't take excess. We don't destroy any. We try to protect the environment as well and the fish. We care about the fish. We're there to fish them. We also eat them. We provide them to the community as a substance. I propose no change to the current fishing regulations for smelt fishing. My family's been involved in all types of fishing for well over 50 years. Both of my sons fish, my husband fishes, my brothers, my father until he passed away. He taught us to respect the resource, and that's what we do. We can go out at any point, at any time, and find loads of smelt. If somebody gets off of their beach and away from their home and goes and looks, they're going to find the smelt. They may not be in their certain area for a certain amount of time, but they'll be back. They're out there. We feel that a lot of education needs to go out. I agree. We need to maintain the resource for all of us. We've invested a lot in our business. It's not just go out and fish. We invest in licenses, bonds, equipment, hand-sewn nets. A lot of work goes into it. We don't use high-tech equipment. We use a 17-foot boat, a net on the bow, and we pull it in by hand. We have a lot of property owners and business owners that come and talk to us that we have a good relationship with, even on Camino Island. They enjoy to watch us catch the fish, and we do it by hand. It's a hard work. It's not easy to do. We provided fish for over 50 years to the markets in Seattle. The consumers deserve the right to buy fish for those people that can't go out and catch smelt, that maybe have physical handicaps, that can't go out and put their net in the water or their dip bag. They deserve the right to have smelt just like everybody else. The commercial fishing has been regulated and managed, and we have to deal with a multitude of things, from tides to property owners to the weather. We want to see enforcement in the sport fishing as well, because I think that that's where you're going to find the majority of fish taken. It's probably not by the commercial fishermen. You're talking 95,000 pounds by commercial fishermen, and there's been documented well over hundreds of thousands of pounds by the sportsmen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Colin English? Okay, Mr. Cousins?
My name is Harvey Cousins, Sr. I've been a commercial fisherman in this state for approximately 38 years now. I also drive school bus during the school season, fish in the summertime. As far as the fish and, you know, the resource that we have out there, the amount of fish, what is going on with them, I have to say I feel the department has a lack of knowledge of where these fish are at, what they're doing at any given time. I have given information to the department as much as I can to try to help them understand the things that I don't read about in their literature. A lot of the problems I see with not just the smelt, but the smelt are a bottom fish. That's what we're licensed to fish, is bottom fish. Those fish come in, they spawn on the bottom. If you contaminate the bottom with nothing but chemicals, things from our sewer treatment facilities, those fish are going to look elsewhere, someplace where they can spawn or, you know, do their thing. Sewer treatment facilities are not allowed to be built, to my understanding, and new ones be built and pump into the Puget Sound. But yet we allow the expansion of all of our sewer treatment facilities, the existing ones. There are a lot of private ones, not just the ones for your cities, but for different communities. That being said, the department should be looking at how much we are contaminating the spawning grounds of not just the smelt, but all the species. Marine mammal stress. I know everybody talks about the harbor seals, the sea lions, and, you know, they need their food. They are herding the smelt into the beach where the smelt have no place to go. If you shove somebody against a wall down into the corner and they keep getting harassed that way, they're not going to keep going there. And I've stressed this for years to the department that perch that I used to fish along with smelt, same thing. We witnessed schools of them being herded by the seals and sea lions, so they quit coming to the beach. If you look at the records, we don't fish perch anymore. They don't come to the beach. And we fish a beach seine, which is 350 feet long. When you try to encircle fish that you have to visually see in the water and pull that net in by hand around the obstacles, the rocks, everything out there, by the time you get your net in, you don't. It's not that easy to catch fish. You don't always catch fish. But there are also places other than in front of the landowner's home to fish. We need to find better access. All beaches in the state belong to the people. They need to stop calling them private beaches. If you take away the commercial fishery, you are going to put more people out there to try to dip smelt or get them from somewhere. of which you will have more trespassing, so hopefully they don't encourage more trespassing in the Puget Sound, if that's what they want to call it. They need to straighten out the trespassing issue and bring back the public beaches, not private beaches. I appreciate your time in listening to this. I know you're going to hear it again and again, but we really need to focus on taking care of the resource and not the individual property owner's beach. So thank you again, and have a good day.
Joshua Cousins, you come forward, please. Okay, Mr. English.
The perceived decline in forage fish, smelt, and whatnot seems to be supported in a lot of data now. There's a NOAA study that came out in 2011 that shows there's been a decrease in biomass in the North and South Sound since the 70s, I guess. And some of the data that they're working off of is fish and wildlife data that also shows a decline in smelt, Dan Pantilla's data. Dave, Dr. Lowry might actually kind of correct me on some of this. This biomass corresponds with an increasing population, so there are more of us living around the Puget Sound. As this occurs, the jobs of the people managing the fish become more and more important. Right now, they don't have the money to properly manage the fish. They can tell you where they will find, they think, smelt. They have done the research on that, and they have published data on that. But they can't actually go out and check that. They can just sort of give you, you know, the general regions. They don't have the money to enforce people harvesting it at a recreational level. They can go to the commercial fishermen because they're licensed and they can locate them, but they can't actually track people recreationally fishing. So, or not with the resources they currently have. There's studies that show that there's a decline in diving birds who rely on forage fish, and this is, I can direct you to that study. It's also pending publication. So these things are all kind of coming together. The fact that Fish and Wildlife don't have the resources that they need indicates to even make an estimate of how many smelt are there. They can't tell you how many smelt are there. They can only tell you that the commercial fishermen are taking a certain amount. They don't know what the recreational fishermen necessarily are doing. This indicates to me that you should take a great deal of caution when managing this fishery, and I think you should look at the fourth option and shut it down completely until we have either better data or you see a bounce. The fish come back pretty quickly. That might be possible. Otherwise, take the third. I mean, I would go for the third option, but I think that it's reached a point where the declines are notable. They're tracked to some extent in data, and it would behoove us to stop and pause and wait to see if the fish come back and the birds. I guess that's about all I can say.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Cousins.
My name is Joshua Cousins. Last year was my first year. I put my own boat together and a net and everything and went out fishing on my own. I've fished my entire life since I was a kid with my father, my grandpa, my uncles, my brother, and you know, I've been around the fish my entire life, the smelt, the perch. I didn't do a lot of the fishing for perch when I was younger. But from what I'm looking at with the numbers for smelt alone, our averages went up from even the 90s when our average was in the 60,000s up to an average of 80,000 plus pounds a year. And also in the study which my mom, Terry, touched on about the biomass study estimate for the sound was that, and that was in 1995, a peak year for us was 116,000 pounds, and that was less than 1% of the biomass of smelt in the Puget Sound, which puts the number of smelt over 10 million pounds of an estimate of a biomass. I know they manage herring, at least with, this is one of your guys, the department studies, is that they manage herring out to 20%, which I can understand why that means there's a big decline in the herring because of everything else too. But the amount of smelt and other fish that I see out there, I understand the homeowners might not see as many fish as the fishermen do. I spend a lot of time in my boat. I'm out there. I don't fish just on the high tide. I will go out there and I will fish all day and all night long And some days I don't see as many fish. I'll see small schools of fish, or I'll see fish up on the beach spawning. And I won't set my net on the fish spawning because they're not in big concentrations. They'll be spread out, you know, for a few feet off the beach for a long ways, but there's no big concentration to dense them out. So I leave them alone, and that allows them to spawn, and everything relieves the pressure on the fish. As for birds, other fish, steelhead, Dolly Varden, sand sharks, I see mass amounts of fish that I catch in the net that I release when I get to the bag of the net. When I'm actually scooping the fish out of the bag of my net, I release I'll get salmon in the net sometimes. And I set them back in the water, make sure they're rehabilitated, they can swim away, and let them go. I'm in no big hurry once I set my net. I've only got usually a short window to catch fish, usually around high tide, but I have also caught fish at minus tides, low tide, incoming, outgoing, and it just depends when the fish come into the beach, when they want to go. I've seen them off the beach where I can't catch them because my net isn't deep enough to go that far. But, I mean, I sat and looked at schools. I can look both ways down the beach as far as I can see with a pair of binoculars and not see the end of a school of smelt. And, you know, sitting there watching them, I can't touch them. But they're continuously going. Yesterday I went for a boat ride. I brought a friend of mine I've known since we were kids, and he has came out fishing with me. And his uncle, we went out yesterday, almost low tide, and I showed him five different schools of smelt around down in Sinclair Inlet, and I showed him a school of anchovies, a school of herring, and I was just not expecting to see anything, just going for a boat ride. And I looked in one small section of beach is where I seen those fish, and I showed him where I've fished over there. But along with the fishing for us, you know, I am supportive of option one, because with the night closure, that would drastically affect how I could fish and how many fish I could catch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. You all did an excellent job presenting your viewpoints. We appreciate that. Thank you for attending. That closes the public hearing.